The Lord be with you.
Let us pray.
Father, we thank you that you told us to love our neighbors. And then, Father, in the new covenant, you've reminded us that everyone is our neighbor by the covenant of grace. Pray, Lord, that you would now capture our hearts, enliven your spirit within us, that we might hear everything that you've placed on Dave Runyon's heart, but also, Lord, that we might be moved to be neighbors, to build the kingdom of God, to serve Jesus Christ, all that we may know your pleasure, Father in heaven. We pray for Pastor Runyon. We pray for him, Lord, that you might use him, anoint him, Lord, give him a holy boldness that is beyond him, that as he brings this great gift to us, that it might be a blessing to him and to us. For Jesus' name we pray. Amen. So please, now, if you will, welcome Pastor Dave Runyon.
Thank you. All right, now, yep, it was good call. It was user error. So I'll re-rack that. So my name's Dave. I served as a pastor for 10 years in the Denver metro area. I worked at two great churches. And then I encountered a series of crises that changed the trajectory of my life. And now I spend most of my time helping congregations work together, mostly around issues with the poor. And the first thing that happened to me is I got obsessed with John 17. And I was serving with my church right outside in a suburb, right outside of Denver. And it was just one of those things where I was reading through the text and I came across Jesus' prayer in John 17. And in this incredible moment of his life, right before he's arrested, he prays for himself and for what he's getting ready to go through. He prays for the disciples, and then he prays for all of us. He prays for every believer alive at that time and every believer to come. And as many of you in this room know, in that moment, of all the things that he could pray for, he prays for unity. He prays that we would be one. Not just that our church would be one, or our denomination that would be one, that followers of him would be one. And he says that he doesn't just pray for unity for the sake of unity. He prays for unity. He says that when there's unity, people that don't know God get sucked towards him. And I am sitting there reading that prayer, and I just have this thought of, like, what if this is actually true? And I started to weigh that against all the things that I was up to as a pastor and as a leader. And I just couldn't. It was one of those things where I think sometimes you get obsessed with a piece of scripture. It can be unhealthy. And you just like focus on just one part. But it was one of those things for me that I just kept thinking and dwelling. And I would go to bed at night thinking about this and for about 6 months. And I would wake up thinking about it. And then I started to have more and more breakfasts and lunch meetings with other pastors and leaders and priests in our city. And over time, a few of us started to gather, and we started to think and to dream and to pray about what is it that we could do together in our community? What's the smart, if you were actually going to mobilize all of the believers, and our little town was about 130,000, our little suburb of Denver, and we just started there. We started kind of focusing local. If you were going to mobilize all the people that go to all those churches, what's the smartest thing that you could do? And we didn't know the answer to that question. Which, by the way, is an indictment on you if you're a pastor. Okay? And so what we did is we started to have these little community conversations, and we reach out to a police chief, a city manager, and about 9 years ago, I was sitting in a room with our mayor, and there's 22 faith leaders from 22 different congregations in the room, and we would have these little gatherings, and we would just simply say, you know, tell us, what's your dream for our city? And then we'd ask this question, if you could wave a magic wand and change something in our community, what would you change? And whenever we asked somebody that question, we'd all get out our little pens and papers and get excited and start writing down because we thought, all right, this is going to be it. This is going to tell us what we should be up to in our city. And so our mayor comes into the room, and we had told him what we were going to ask him before he got there, because that's, if you want to get a civic leader to come into a room with a bunch of pastors, you better tell them you're not going to do anything strange to them. And so we told him what we were going to do. So he brings out this piece of paper. And he starts to read down this list, and he just says, you know, I want to live in a city where there's no elderly shut-ins. I want to live in a city where there's no single moms below the poverty line. There's no financial debt, at-risk kids. And he just goes on. And there's about 11 things on this list. And most of them are really good. There's some weird, he said, like, hey, we need a better newspaper. And we were like, this is the wrong room for that. So anyway, he gets done, he folds the piece of paper up and he puts it in his back pocket. And then very much in passing, he just says, you know, if you guys want to have the biggest impact on our city, you'd start some kind of a neighboring movement. And then he just goes on. He started, and we're like, no, what do you mean? Go back to that. He said, yeah, you know, what we're learning as city leaders is that the closer that people know each other based on proximity, the less weight there is on all the systems that we're trying to provide and to create for people in need. You know, we can start another program for elderly shut-ins, or that person who doesn't have family around, who's growing older and more isolated, could live on a block or in a townhome or an apartment where the people who live around him or her actually care for them and know them and are attentive to what's going on in their life. Said, you know, we can start another Boys and Girls Club, which they were in the process of doing, which is over $4 million, or that kid who's missing a father figure could live on a block where other healthy adults are aware of who he is and bringing them into the life and the fabric of their family. And then he said this beautiful line. He said, what we're learning at the city is that relationships always trump programs. Yeah, that'll preach, right? He said, you know, the majority of the issues that our community is facing could be eliminated or drastically reduced if we could just become a community of great neighbors. And he had no idea what he was doing to us at that time. Like, put yourself in that room. Okay, imagine that, like, this won't be hard for some of you. Imagine, like, you make your living helping people connect with God and orient their lives around this. Okay? Now, imagine what it feels like when God uses your mayor to tell you that the smartest thing that you can do for your city is the most basic teaching in this. Like, hey, I mean, he was basic. What we heard him say, and he was not saying this. And by the way, like, he was not, you know, kind of a religious person at the time. What we heard him saying is, hey, you know what you guys should do, all of you pastors? You want to do the smartest thing for our city? You should get your people to actually do the Bible. Yeah, it was, again, it was another bad moment. And I'll never forget, so he leaves the room, we pray, and one of the pastors kind of looks around and just says, you know, this is really convicting, and a lot of times, anytime something interesting happens to me, it ends up in a sermon that weekend. That doesn't happen in South Carolina, but in Denver, that happens a lot. And so he had the wisdom to say, hey, what if we made a commitment not to go and preach about this and just pray about it and then come back and meet a couple months later? And we all agreed to that. And I remember driving home from that meeting, and there was a ton of thoughts running through my head, but the two that I can really remember are this. I had this thought. I'm driving back into my little loop of homes out in the suburbs, 42 homes, and my first thought was this. I thought to myself, Jesus is smart. You would think that a lot as a pastor, but I didn't. I thought, Jesus, what if when Jesus gets asked to boil the entire text down to one thing, what if he has given us a very simple strategic plan that if every believer did it, it would actually change the world overnight? That was my first thought. My second thought, I just realized I wasn't doing it. As a pastor, I had filled my life up. I was sitting on the board of three different nonprofits. I was deeply engaged in people's marriages in my church, and they're trying to figure out their life with their kids. I would, like, go and set up these outreach events and, like, just hope somehow, some way, people outside of our community would attend. And I had just filled my life up with so many different things that I had almost zero margin for being intentional about what was happening right outside my front door. And as I was reflecting on that, I went into my house. My wife, Lauren, has been ahead of me on most things, and including neighboring. And so I told her everything about what happened, and she just looked at me and said, what are you going to do about it? And I didn't want to have a lot of accountability. And so what I said was, I'm going to hang out in the front yard more for the next year and just see what happens. Now, that sounds like I'm trying to get out of something, which I think I was, but just being in my front yard and just being willing to actually think, maybe this counts. Maybe, like, what I'm doing out here counts. Just that little simple act, that little one-year experiment has lasted 9 years, and it has totally messed up my whole life. It has hurled me into relationships and connections with people that I would never naturally choose to be with. And one of the things that I didn't realize that had happened to me is after 10 years of full-time vocational, you know, leading at churches, I got into vocational ministry because I love seeing people's lives collide with the life of Jesus. Like, that's when that happens, I just, like, it does something. I just either get chills or weep, or, you know, that's why I got into the game. And after 10 years of being on staff, I had drifted into a place, and I wasn't really aware of this. It was later on, kind of looking back, but I had drifted into a place where I was dying. Like, that part of me was dying. I became a type of person who most of my deep friendships, most of the people that I had friendships with of any kind of depth or relationships with any kind of depth, they all thought about the world the same way that I did. And I didn't know that I was drying up and that I was dying, but I was. And what happened through this idea of just being available, of just actually going and making some connections with people who live right outside my front door, is that if when you do that, you're guaranteeing that you're going to be hanging out with people who think about the world differently than you do, and who have different beliefs about politics and about God and about how to raise your kids and all of those different things. And as I just started to become a little bit more available, God just started to put some wind back in my sails. Started to, like, remind me of my original calling. And it's beautiful, and it's really messy, and it's hard. It's like, the only thing I can describe, it's like having kids, okay? My kids are really hard, and I don't ever want to go back. And that's how I feel about neighboring. I feel the exact same way. And so I'll tell you a little bit more later about what's going on in my own neighborhood. But let me take you back to that little group of pastors. So we decide we're going to pray for 2 months and reflect on what happened, and then we're going to come back and get together. So that same group of pastors comes back together. We invite in our assistant city manager. Her name was Vicki Ryer. And she was kind of like the bridge between everything that happens on the streets in our community and then all the bureaucracy of city stuff. And I had been running around and annoying leaders in my city with that magic wand question for a couple of years. And people every once in a while would go, hey, you should go talk to Vicki Ryer. You should go talk to Vicki Ryer. And this is previous to the mayor meeting. I would go and talk to Vicki, and Vicki would always tell me the same thing. She would say, hey, you know what you should do with all those people that show up to all those churches is that next time it snows, this isn't very relevant to South Carolina again, but next time it snows, you should get those people to shovel their neighbor's driveway. And when she said it to me, I would just think to myself, no. Like, that's not it. Like, I wanted something really sexy. Like, I was envisioning, like, the newspaper headline. It was like, you know, the church eradicates homelessness in our community or something like that. Okay, but Vicki had been trying to tell me, and what I learned later is Vicki is the one who had been in the mayor's ear and in civic leaders that are saying literal neighboring matters. And so I invite Vicki to come and to sit in on our meeting. And towards the end of that meeting, and a lot of the we're kind of going around sharing, hey, who's really engaged in their own neighborhood? And out of those 22 leaders, there were 2 people who were really good neighbors. You look at them and go, you're one of the best neighbors on your block, okay, of all of those lead pastors. So Vicki comes in, and she starts to share at the end. She just starts to talk with us about, like, all these really pragmatic ways of why literal neighboring makes a big difference in communities. She talks about the fact that the crime rate is significantly less in neighborhoods where people know the first names of their neighbors. She quoted Malcolm Gladwell's book, Outliers, and talked about the fact that people live significantly longer when they're connected to their neighbors, that when there's a natural disaster, and you would know about this here, when there's a natural disaster, oftentimes, most often, your neighbors are your first responders because the systems get overwhelmed. And we're all just sitting there and listening to her, and we're like, oh, that's good. We're writing all this stuff down. And in the back of our mind, we're also thinking, and Jesus said to do this. Okay? And so at the very end, she has a little interaction with one of the pastors in the room that just kind of cemented for us that we were going to act. But one of the pastors asked a question. She looked at him, and very, very innocently, she just said, hey, like, from the city's perspective, we don't see a difference in the way Christians and non-Christians treat their actual neighbors. We started to argue with her about her perception. We're like, no, that can't be true. And then we stopped arguing with her, and we just realized, oh, she's right. in our city, there isn't a drastic, noticeable difference in the way Christians and non-Christians treat their actual neighbors. And by the way, I have shared her quote in rooms now with leaders from over 500 different cities. Never once has a police chief, city manager, a mayor come up to me and go, "Oh, Dave, no, in my city, the Christians are the best neighbors. It's not even close." Okay? Now, that should mess with us. That should put us into, that was my third moment of crisis. As I started to think, how in the world, over and over again, and Jesus just says, listen, if you only do one thing, if you want to boil the entire text down to one thing, it's love the Lord your God with your heart, soul, mind, strength, and love your neighbor as yourself. How do we hold that in tension with the fact that in our cities, in our states, in our country, in our culture, there isn't a drastic, noticeable difference in the way Christians and non-Christians treat their actual neighbors? And as I started to try to wrestle through that, I started to get irritated. Do you ever you ever see something? I'm sure this has not happened recently. You ever see something on the news and you start to get mad? Okay, that's what happened to me. I started to think about this. I started to get mad and angry. And then I asked a different question, and it changed my mood. I started to ask this question. I wonder how you become a pastor who's not engaged in his own neighborhood. And I went from being irritated to being convicted and reflective, and I started to read through the text with just a new lens. I started to see things, stories that I had taught multiple sermons on, that I had read hundreds of times, just started to take on this new light. And I'll share one of them with you here this morning. It's in Luke 10, and it's a passage that I would be willing to guess almost every person in this room has read multiple times. And so I'll just read it to you. And then you can I just invite you to take a look at this through a new lens. I believe what happened to me is I became inoculated to what is the most important teaching of the Bible. I just got so close to it and so familiar with it. And Dallas Willard says this, he says, familiarity breeds unfamiliarity. And that's what happened to me in relation to this idea of loving your neighbor. So Luke 10, this teacher of the law comes to Jesus and says this, Luke 10:25. On one occasion, an expert in the law stood up to test Jesus. "Teacher," he asked, "what must I do to inherit eternal life?" "What is written in the law?" he replied. "How do you read it?" Okay, Jesus does this a couple times throughout the Gospels. He gets the person asking the question to answer their own question because he knows there's something bigger going on. He, the teacher of the law, answered, "Love the Lord your God with all of your heart, with all your soul, with all your strength, with all your mind, and love your neighbor as yourself." "You have answered correctly," Jesus replied. "Do this and you will live." Just think about how powerful that is right there. Just do this and you will live. So the guy comes, he asks Jesus a very straightforward question. He gives the textbook correct answer. Jesus looks at him and says, "Yes, do this and you will live." And then this next little part is what just came flying off the page at me. It says this, but he wanted to justify himself, so he asked Jesus, "And who is my neighbor?" His first thought is, how do I get out of this? Where is the loophole? But he wanted to justify himself, so he asked Jesus, "And who is my neighbor?" And as I was reading through that story with everything that happened with the mayor, with everything that was going on, I just saw myself in the text. Do you want to know how you can become a pastor who's not engaged in his own neighborhood? The secret is right here in what this guy does. His first thought, Jesus, neighbor, I wonder what that really means. What do you really mean by that? His first thought is I wonder if I can define that word neighbor so that it most easily fits into what I'm already up to. How I became a pastor for a long time, 10 years, without really being engaged in my neighborhood is that I just defined that word so that it most easily fit into what I was already up to. Would you like to know how we can become a culture of people who aren't known and differentiated by the way we treat our literal neighbors? This guy gives us the answer. All you have to do is lead a bunch of people who just use that idea of loving your neighbor as kind of a metaphor, and they just kind of define that word neighbor as something that really fits into what they're already doing and discomforts them the least. And what Jesus does is brilliant. He looks at this guy and he goes, "Oh, we're going to play the how do you define the neighbor game." And he tells the story of the Good Samaritan. Now, catch this though. He's assuming that this guy is being a neighbor to the people of the same culture and custom. And so he just blows up the definition of neighbor on this guy. He gives him like AP, Advanced Placement Neighboring. Okay, that's what the story of the Good Samaritan is. The story of the Good Samaritan, in my mind, for 10 years as a pastor, I thought the big idea of the story of the Good Samaritan was everybody is our neighbor. That's not what the big idea. The story says when you care for the person in front of you, no matter who it is, you're loving your neighbor. But in my mind, I had turned that. I did some little mental gymnastics move to kind of basically what that says is everybody's your neighbor. And when everybody's your neighbor, oftentimes very few or nobody is. And so I just ended up with this really powerful metaphoric love for my metaphoric neighbor. And metaphorically, I was just killing it. And in real life, there were people who were sleeping 30, 40, 50 feet away from me, and I didn't even know their names. And God just used this whole convergence to just get really, really clear in my own life that I had drifted and that I had missed something that was incredibly important. And if you're like me, there might be a few thoughts going through your head right now, so I'm just going to beat you to it. Okay? You might be thinking to yourself, you know, Dave, I spend way more time at work than I do in my neighborhood. Dave, I'm building these relationships with parents on my kids' sports team, on my grandkids' sports team, and I'm really passionate about what happens at the mission or overseas, and you don't know how much time I spend. And I want to say something really clearly. If you're doing all of those things clearly in Jesus' economy, that's loving your neighbor. I don't want to diminish that. I don't want to devalue it in any way. Clearly, that's true. But here's the deal. All of that doesn't somehow sprinkle magic fairy dust over our actual neighborhoods, and all of a sudden Jesus wasn't talking about them. And I lived most of my life like that was the case. Like, I'm choosing to do all of these other things, or I feel called to do all of these other things, and so my life is super busy and really hectic, and so somehow Jesus didn't actually mean the people that live right around me. Now, when you say it out loud, it sounds crazy. But if you don't articulate it and you just let yourself kind of drift into it, it's really easy to get there. At least it was for me. And what I've come to learn, what my friends and I have come to learn in my city, the faith leaders and then a lot of our people, is that if we as believers will just draw a circle around the places that God has put us and begin to work out from there, that the kingdom breaks out more often than not. And that we didn't need AP neighboring. What we needed was actually kindergarten neighboring. And that they're like going back and making things really concrete and really simple has a lot of power to it. And so one of our city leaders and my buddy Jay, who wrote the book with me, came up with this really simple exercise that had a profound impact in our community. And I'm going to do it with you this morning because it's that important. And this, like what we're getting ready to do, this little thing I'm getting ready to do with you, this is 100 times better than the book that my buddy and I wrote. This is, yes. That and the books, yeah, it's not that good even. So I don't know what that says about this, what we're going to do. So here's this right here, okay? If you have a piece of paper in front of you, I want you to take this refrigerator magnet home and use a Sharpie or something like that with it. So don't write on this unless you have a Sharpie or something right now. I want you just to, on a piece of paper in front of you, draw a tic-tac-toe board. Okay, so draw a tic-tac-toe board, something that looks like this. And I can still remember doing this for the first time as just our little 22 pastors sitting in a room. So we all drew the tic-tac-toe board. Now, that middle house, you can just draw an X or whatever there. In that middle square, that's where you live. Now, here's the exercise. Here's the little test that I'm going to give you. I want you to imagine that you walk outside the front door of your townhome, apartment, condo, whatever it is. Okay, so you walk outside. Now, I know that your neighborhood probably doesn't look like a perfect tic-tac-toe board, but just kind of imagine, what are the 8 logical closest units to you? You're like your 8 closest neighbors of wherever you live. Okay, you got it in your head? Now, I want you to take a minute. I just want you to write down the names of the adults in those 8 units. Just take a second, right where you are. Just kind of write down the names of the people. Now, if you don't know their name, just leave it blank. And I'd like you to know that when I first did this, I could only fill in both boxes in 2 of these 8 squares. So if there's 2 adults that live there, just write down the adults' names. If you know some of the kids' names, you can write them down, or a dog, or whatever like that. That's extra points. But don't write down annoying lady, okay? Dude that drives a blue car. Just if you don't know their name, just leave it blank. And as you're writing this down, if you were like me, you're going to have this realization. You're like, oh no, I've met all of these people multiple times. And there's some of them that I just don't even remember their name. How many of you, if I called you up here right now, you think you can rattle off the adults' names in all eight of those? Go ahead and raise your hand. That's high. How many of you, if I called you up here right now, you can write them down, both adults' names in five or more? Raise your hand. That's really, that's like 35% of the room. I do this a lot. By the way, we have handed out about 320,000 of these magnets. Okay, so I've had this conversation way more than I thought I would 9 years ago. I've never been in a room of believers where more than half of the room can write down more than half of their neighbor's names. Ouch. Here's why I think this is important. I think that we should all, or can all agree to this. In order to love somebody, it's helpful to know their first name. Right? I can't tell you what it felt like the first time I did this. I just realized, oh my goodness. Many of the people around me who I've met, they're not important enough to me personally for me to remember, to retain, and to use their names when I see them. But we're not talking about loving somebody, okay? That's like crazy Jesus stuff, okay? We're talking about just like, are the people around us valuable enough to know their names? And it was just, God just like was just saying, hey, it's just tapping on my heart saying, this isn't okay. This isn't okay. And I'm going to tell you what happened with this thing. So I had a napkin. It was a tic-tac-toe board like the one you just drew, and it was posted up on my fridge. And it had those two in there. And my wife could fill in some of the others, but she didn't do that for me because she's mean. And so she just let me sit with it. And all this stuff was happening, and I'm sitting out there, and I just made a decision. I'm like, this isn't okay. I'm going to do this. And I can remember this like it was just the other day. I was sitting at the top of my driveway, and one of my neighbors, who was a blank square who I'd met before, was mowing his lawn out and to the left, just right across my street. And I sat there, and I thought to myself, yes, okay, this is a great chance. And then before I even took a step, I thought, you know what? I can't go up and talk to him while he's mowing his lawn. That's really awkward. And then I thought, well, I'll just make up something to do in my front yard when he gets done. I thought, nope, that's more awkward. And I actually had this thought. I thought to myself, I'll go inside my house, and I bet when I come back out. And I just, right then, I just stopped. I said, you're doing it. You're trying to find a loophole. And I remember I taking that first step. I just stepped down my driveway, and I started walking out, and I walked over to the left, and he's sitting there, and he's mowing his lawn. He's kind of looking at me. And it was awkward. And by the way, if you want to be a good neighbor, here's the main thing that you need to have. You need to have a willingness to lean into mildly awkward moments. Okay? And so I walked up to him. He stops the lawnmower. And I said, hey, man, which was my name for him. My other neighbor was Bro. I kept them totally separate. And I thought that was really big of me. I was like, yeah, I got this stuff down. So anyway, hey, man, this is really embarrassing. I know I've lived next to you for 2 years, and I know that I've met you three times, but I forgot your name. And he was really gracious. And he said, hey, yeah, I'm Matt. My wife, Jan, we talked for 20 seconds. And then I walked into my house, and I did something incredibly important. I went up to my refrigerator, and I wrote it down. That's it. And after about 6 weeks of conversations like this, this whole thing was filled in, and it was sitting on my refrigerator. I could see it every day, and God did something to me. All of a sudden, these people went from, you know, people that drove certain types of cars, had certain types of kids, that did certain activities, to like real people with real names and with real stories. And as I started to use their names when I saw them, it just got us unstuck. It just got us nudged just enough. And sometimes, like, so much of momentum is just getting started. And sometimes when you just get a nudge, sometimes you can't stop it. These organic things start to happen as a result. And so for me, with this one neighbor, it went from, hey, man, to, hey, Matt, to, hey, Matt, did you see the end of that game? You know, the one where the Broncos beat the Panthers in the Super Bowl? too close to home. So, yeah, that game. And did you see the end? Wasn't that incredible? And it's us just talking for a few minutes. And then it was, hey, Matt, I've got this thing in my garage. I seem to move it a few feet. Could you help me out? To, hey, your son's car is back there all the time now. Like, did he move back in? And how's that going? To, hey, like, you guys are going to be watching the game and we're watching it. Let's just watch it together. And then to, like, sitting across a dining room table, like, sharing our lives with each other. Like, talking about the things that we love. Talking about, you know, like, how did you end up as a high school teacher? What was that first calling look like? And why do you guys, like, back your car out every Sunday and go to church? And, you know, it, like, just, like, this thing I had been dreaming about as I was setting up chairs for different outreach events, like, it was all, like, sitting right there outside my front door. But I wasn't living in a way where I could access it. And what I've just learned over and over again is if when the people of God are just willing to lean in a little bit, when we're just willing to live a little bit below the depth, or below the surface, to get a little bit of depth, some of our neighbors are dying for it. Now, some of my neighbors aren't. Some of my neighbors are really, really busy. And they come home and they grab their kids and then they go off to all their different activities and then they grab some fast food on the way home. They come in and the garage door goes up and then it goes down and then they go and they detox from everything that happened that day. And then they wake up the next day and do it over again. And when I try to engage them, they're polite, but I can tell they're not that interested. And I have a lot of grace for that because I think that's the way my neighbors experienced me for a long time. But some of my neighbors are dying for something more. I got into church life and I just started to assume that most people have somebody that they can connect with when things aren't going great or that they can have conversations of depth with. And what I've come to realize is that most of my neighbors, most of whom are not engaged in any kind of faith community, that they have their dysfunctional family of origin stuff that we all have, and then they have this surfacey stuff at work, and that's it. And that if I just like lean in a little bit, if I just ask them any kind of question or anything they're passionate about, that some of them just come to life. And I've just come to learn there's this huge difference between proximity-based relationships and affinity-based relationships. Affinity-based relationships are what we're really good at creating in most churches, is that we end up getting people of the same types of kids in the same age group together, and they become a small group. And then this other group, you know, that's a little bit older, maybe empty nesters, and they become a small group. And then that people kind of just drift into each other. Like, if you leave me alone to just kind of, like, gravitate towards different groups of people, I end up with people who love sports and who are funny and rich. I'm just being honest. This is like my self-assessment, okay? I like to laugh, so I end up with funny people. I have a very unhealthy obsession with sports, so I end up with people like that. And then somewhere along the line, I just learned if you hang out with rich people, you're rich for a day. You're just like, oh, I got to use all your stuff. That was neat. Okay, so if you do an autopsy of all the small groups that I've ever been in, that's what they look like. Proximity-based relationships, it doesn't get you the socioeconomic stuff, but man, it gets you everything else. I have friends now that like things that I have no interest in, or at least that I used to have no interest in. I have friends now who I used to go, I'd go to like get an oil change and they go, oh yeah, your headlight's out, and I'm paying like, you know, some stupid amount of money to get a headlight. Meanwhile, my neighbor is sitting across the street working on his car all the time. It never dawned on me to actually look at him and go, hey, listen, I don't know how to change a headlight. Could we go to the auto parts store together and could you teach me how to do this? Which really just means, can you do it and I'll watch. But that time going to the store and coming back, that counts. And there's something beautiful that happens in that exchange. I have neighbors that are socially awkward and that like just say things that like I feel like you should probably have a better boundary there. And like learn how to, I have neighbors that like, it's just opened up my world. And what we've learned as we started to do this with the people that show up to our churches is it opens up their world too. that what we ended up doing is we ended up just throwing people into ministry way above their heads. The conversations in our lobbies changed dramatically. People started to come back going, I think my neighbor's an addict. What should I do? Or I'm watching their marriage just fly apart and disintegrate. What would you do? And those types of conversations reminded us, like what we do on Sundays, that's not the best place to like live out the New Testament. It's a good place. It's not the best place. The best place, like when you actually start to engage with the people that God has put around you who think about the world from all different angles, that's where the magic happens. That's like where all of these things that we talk about, that's where they all come to life. That's where you now are equipped to go and engage and be the type of person who can actually be a pastor, be a leader, be somebody of depth where you live. There's this great text. I mean, the New Testament, the Old Testament, they're just soaked with this deep theology of place, and we've lost it. Like most of us in our like culture today, most of us as believers don't have a really robust theology of place, but it's all over the place. Acts 17, I love, you know, Paul's sitting there and he's on Mars Hill in Athens and he's talking to all these people and he gives the great sermon about the character of God. And one of the things that he says in that moment, he says, from one man he made every nation of men that they should inhabit the whole earth, and he determined the time set for them in the exact places where they should live. God did this so that men would seek him and perhaps reach out for him and find him, though he is not far from each one of us. He determined the time set for them in the exact places where they should live. I always thought that I lived where I lived because I always wanted to have four bedrooms up. We have four kids. And I always wanted to like have like this kind of like set up and a great backyard and be in the right school district. That's not why I live where I live. I live where I live because God placed me there. He actually put me there, if I believe the text. And he placed the people around me there. And I don't know what your situation is. I don't know where you live. Maybe it's because you can't afford the place that you really want to go to. Maybe you live in an apartment and you're getting ready to move soon. You're thinking to yourself, no, I don't want to like meet any of these people because I'm going to leave in four. I don't know. Maybe it's you're like me and you always wanted to have this and that's why you think you live there. No, none of that's true. You live where you live because God put you there. There's something sacred about where you live. And when we as believers actually like get that, when that's, it changes everything. It changes the way you drive into your neighborhood. It changes the way you drive out, back in and out of your neighborhood. It changes the way our people start to think about ministry. You start to actually like get people back to the basics, and they'll start having this thought of like, oh my goodness, what I do in my front yard counts. And by the way, it does. It's just as good as being on vestry or the finance committee or working with kids. Or be, all of those things are good, and that is ministry, but so is what we do right outside our front door. And when that happens, when you start to validate that for people, when you start to give them a vision for living like that, you won't be able to stop what's going to happen. If we as leaders can just begin to say, hey, what you do in your front yard counts too. If we ask those kind of, what if Jesus meant our actual neighbors as well when he said to love your neighbor? Just being the types of people that can ask those questions and lead people down that road. And by the way, to lead these people down the road, you actually have to do it in your own life. You actually have to be the type of person that's taking small steps with the people who live right around you. If you don't, then you're just going to end up doing a really good sermon series and then get on to the next one. And so we've worked with 2,500 churches, more than that, and most of them do a really good sermon series. And if you want to do that, like, go to our website. We've got free, you don't have to prep for 3 weeks. We've got free sermons and everything on there. Just go do a good sermon series. But some churches actually change the DNA of their church. This actually gets baked into who they are. And those churches, the things that they do, the things that we notice is the senior leaders actually are taking steps in their own life. They're actually taking small steps. They actually have, like, if you're not involved in your neighbor, you actually have kind of a moment of repentance like I did, and you started to say, this isn't okay, and I'm going to just do some small things to see what God does with the people who live around me. And if you're that type of person, you won't be able to shut up about it. you'll be one of those people who, like, something interesting happens during the week and you just jam it into your sermon even though it doesn't belong there. By the way, I think that's a good thing when you're talking about what God's doing in the life of your neighborhood. So I want to do this for a second. I've talked for a while. I want to just give you a moment to go around with the people that are at your table. I want you to share your block map with them. Okay, we're only going to take about 5-7 minutes to do this. I want you to share your block map and go, hey, here's where I'm at. And just talk about the vibe of your neighborhood. What's the current, like, kind of, you know, vibe of your neighborhood? And then maybe compare it to some places that you've lived in the past. So we've only got 5 minutes. You're going to have to only talk for about, you know, 45 seconds or 1 minute each. But share your block map. Where are you at with it right now? And then talk about the current kind of relational connections in your neighborhood. And then introduce yourself, too, because you probably don't know each other. So, and then learn their names. Remember their names. All right, we're going to jump back in. A lot of you, this is exciting. You guys actually have something to talk about. I was up in Boston last month. They didn't have this much to say about their neighbors. All right, so hopefully you guys get, you have a chance to eat lunch together too, so you can kind of pick up some of the conversation. Whenever I share a little bit about my story, and whenever you get this concrete about neighboring, a lot of different questions arise. And by the way, I would like to say this, especially to any of the faith leaders in the room. Here was one of our biggest learnings. My whole life, people told me good leaders set the bar high. And I think that's true if you're leading a small group, a staff team, whatever it is. But here's what we learned about trying to start a movement. We started off with about 26,000 people in our city that we were speaking to. We did a joint sermon series in our community. And so we all kind of put our own agendas aside, and for 3 weeks we went after this together. And we still do that in our city. We do this joint sermon series every year. The first 3 years is around neighboring, but now we've branched off into some different things. But here's the thing that we learned. If you want to start a movement, the key isn't to set the bar high. The key is to set the bar so low that people can't crawl underneath it. And, no, this is like a really simple, and we fell into this backwards, okay? What we did, we didn't ask people to love their neighbor. We said, would you be willing, we looked at all of our people and all of our churches and said, would you be willing to learn and retain and use your neighbor's names? And by setting the bar that low was something that's very, very concrete. Okay, what you give them when you give them this is you give them every single person their own little parish. And you give them a way to measure, like, am I making any progress with my little parish? And so it was so concrete that, and it was so clear that we found that people actually did it. Now, it was a Trojan horse to get them to do all kinds of other stuff. Because, like I said, once you get unstuck, you can't stop it a lot of the time. Once you actually start to tell people what you do in your front yard counts, and once you get them to say, you know what, I'm going to tie the idea of knowing somebody's name to the most basic teaching of Jesus. Once you get people there, they'll actually learn those names and use those names, and then in some of those cases, these organic things will start to evolve, and they'll end up actually loving their neighbor. And so that for us was this huge, we didn't plan it that way, we just kind of looking back on it thought, oh my, that's actually what happened. We got so stinking clear about what we did and what we asked people to do that they actually did it. And I think for those of you that teach and lead in faith communities, that's a really important thought. And I remember, so 6 months after we did the first sermon series, we used 2 minutes of the announcement time, and we said, hey, we're going to have a pop quiz today. And people opened up their bulletins, and then this was sitting in their bulletin, a little version of this. Now, a couple interesting things happened. One of the things, and I was there at my church, and people were looking at me like, wait a minute, we already did this. You can't go back to this. We already did this. We're on like 3 different sermon series now, okay? Or different, and it was like we've trained our people to just go from week to week to week to week to week, and to a lot of them, or month to month, and not ever like connect the dots. They just are waiting for us to show up and give them the next new deep teaching. And it takes a lot of courage to say the same basic thing over and over again. And but so that first week we did this pop quiz. 6 months after, we do a pop quiz, and we had everybody, and we just said, hey, just take a minute, write down your neighbors' names that you know. And then we asked the people in all of our churches, we said, if you know a name that you didn't know 6 months ago, will you please just hold your old card up in the air? And all across our city and all these different congregations, 80% of the room is sitting there with their cards up, and you should have seen it. For us as pastors, we were like, oh my goodness, people actually did something because of a sermon. And it was like so encouraging. Like, we were just like, this is amazing. But it was because we made it extremely clear and extremely simple. And so I would just encourage you, as you whatever you're up to, whatever you're trying to communicate about and how you're hoping that your people will experience change and actually take steps towards doing that. And there's a lot of people that are writing about this, about the idea of the power of habit, and the way that people form habits is just by identifying very clear, attainable, small next steps. And so as you think about the people that you lead, I just encourage you to think along those lines. Whenever I share my story, a lot of questions come up. So I'd love just to spend a couple moments here before we dive back in, answering a couple of them. So if you just found yourself listening to me and you're like, yeah, but I wonder about this, just be bold. I need a couple bold people just to like raise their hand and then throw a question at me. All right, yes. And then I'll repeat it so everybody can hear.
Going back to what you said about the awkward moment, willingness to make an awkward moment, and you're going out to meet these people, will you quickly brush over those who were somewhat reluctant? Did you run across that, and how?
The people that were reluctant, like the believers that were reluctant, or the reluctant neighbors? Okay, yeah. So the question is, you're trying to learn how to lean into these mildly awkward moments. What happens when you find a reluctant neighbor? Is that your question? Okay. This happens all the time, is that, we as believers kind of get our courage up and we go, okay, all right, I've lived next to that person, I'm going to go meet them. Most people, especially where you guys live, you find most people are at least fake nice. And some people, there will be the ones that aren't, that are just very, very closed off. We have a neighbor like that who's just incredibly shy and introverted. And my temptation, by the way, when I first met him was to think, he must be up to something bad. No, I really did. Like you just, it's so easy to think the worst. And so I just automatically defaulted into that like thought. But then as I got to know him more and more, I'm like, no, he's just wounded and has just been hurt by people in the past. And I still am not very close to him, but he just always is like kind of like reclusive. And what I've learned is that I have this weird personality where there's a part of me that thinks, oh, that's a challenge. That's not a good thought. You don't want to become a stalker to your neighbors that aren't very interested. Okay, and I think Jesus talks about this. He talks about the person of peace. That's in Luke 10 as well. And he talks about this principle of the person of peace. And so what I would say is, if you can tell that somebody isn't very interested, I wouldn't try to chase them down. I would just go, okay, God, maybe that'll change at some point. Maybe they'll show and they'll lean back toward this. But there's plenty of people that are around me that are open. And I think it's a lot better use of our time to invest in those. So, yes. Yeah. Yep. Yeah. So we've had a lot of success with small. What I would not suggest is blowing up your entire small group structure and then starting over, just based on your neighborhood. We've seen churches try to do that. It's a really hard road to go down. We've had a lot of success with seeing existing small groups just start to build a value of literal neighboring into their small group. But they kind of think of themselves as, this is home base for us to come and get equipped and to get tooled up and inspired to go back out and to do the kinds of things that we do in our places of work and home. The best thing that you can do is this, is that take 5 minutes at the end of every small group, okay? And if this is like, we wrote all this small group curriculum and all of these videos, shot all these videos, and they're fine. But this one thing right here makes more difference than anything else, is that if you take 5 minutes at the end of a group and you just go around the circle and you have everybody just share this, and we'll do a little exercise at the end of our time, but if they just share, hey, this is what I think the next small step in my neighborhood with one of my neighbors I'm supposed to take is. So all you do is if they voice the next small step that they're supposed to take with one of their neighbors, and the rest of the group writes it down and say, yeah, we'll be praying for this throughout the week. And then you know 2 weeks later they're coming back. And a lot of times you'll come back and the person will go, yeah, I actually did not do that. Even if they didn't do it, the fact that they wrote it down and they identified it makes the odds of them doing it go through the roof. And so just that little simple exercise at the end of any small group is just saying, this is, let them identify a small attainable step that they feel prompted to make in their own life and to share it with others. It makes all the difference in the world. And so I would encourage you don't have to take your existing small group structure and blow it up and make it into geographically based systems. It could be a deal where that group of people just starts to actually begin to think and identify things that they think God's calling them to do outside of their group. And so the group becomes a time to come back and report and encourage and grieve with, you know, the successes or failures that's going on outside of the group itself. It's really easy for us to do church in a way where we subconsciously tell our people that this small group is the end game, and it's not. So, yes. You don't need to now. You just heard, I just did the first four chapters. Yeah. Yeah, great question. Are you talking specifically around evangelism and around being able to share? Yeah. Oh, yeah, that's a great question. Let's camp out there for a few minutes. This is the most important thing that we learned. The question was, you know, you talk about being willing to lean into others. What does it look like to be ready to lean in when if they look like that they're open? Let's just talk about motives for a second, because I'll be really honest with you. When all this thing started to happen with our mayor, in the back of my mind, I was kind of thinking, this is going to be an incredible evangelism strategy, okay? Because I'm a pastor, and I think those thoughts sometimes. So here's what we learned, and we do write about this in the book, is that if you go into this thinking this is an evangelism strategy, it rarely ever is. If you go into this thinking that this is a discipline, that this is around an obedience issue with Jesus, then people come to know Jesus all over the place. Here's the hard thing, is that, and this we learned this really early, is that we've done some things in our church culture that have kind of given people the idea that every time they do something nice for somebody that doesn't know God, that means they need to have a very awkward conversation with them on the spot. Okay, I'm going to go over and do this for you, so now I need to ask you, do you know where you're going if you died today? Okay, now, not everyone does that, but some of our people were doing that, and what happens is they get these ulterior motives. I'm going to go love my neighbor, and so then hopefully they're going to ask me this one question, and I'm going to jump on it. Okay, here's the reality. In our culture today, when somebody who is a Christian does something nice for a non-Christian, a lot of times the non-Christian starts bracing themselves for what strange things getting ready to happen to them. And I wish that wasn't the case, but a lot of our brothers and sisters have been doing stuff like that, and so it's kind of put us at a deficit. I think it's important that we go in realizing that and understanding that, and that we go in with this idea, and this is what we've learned kind of in our trainings with our people, is to ask this question. If you knew right now that your neighbor was never going to take a step towards God, do you think the command to love your neighbor still stands? Yes. If you go in with that mindset, you'll be shocked at what happens. So a buddy of mine says this. He says, we don't do this to convert people. We do this because we're converted. Yeah, that'll preach. His name's Eric Swanson. And if you're into like the John 17 stuff, he wrote a great book called To Transform the City. But Eric, Eric just put in a very simple way this idea for me of, yes, I go into this. This is a discipline. This is something that I do out of my walk with Jesus and with God. And here's the deal, by the way. My ultimate motive is I want everyone. There's a bigger difference between ulterior motives and ultimate motives. My ultimate motive is I want everyone I know to be in deep connection with God and to understand his son, Jesus Christ. That's my ultimate motive. But the ulterior motive thing, the bait and switch thing, the I'm just really doing this so I can try to get you to believe like I do, it's hollow. It's counterfeit. And the people who don't know God can sense it. And so we've just learned over and over and over again that our motives are really, really important. And if you do go in, like if you go in with this motive of thinking about this through the discipline and obedience lens, that your friends, your new friends, will be able to tell. And their openness and receptivity and their curiosity about the things that you believe goes way up when that happens. So, now here's the two extremes that people err on, that our people err on. And the smaller group of people would err on this like over eagerness and like, I'm gonna like just jam the gospel down your throat and just kind of like way too soon. And you know, I'm gonna go over to your house and I don't even know your name, and I'm gonna bring a sheet of cookies and my block map, and I'm gonna find out your name and write it down in front of you, give you cookies, and then also give you a card that says, come to our evangelism service at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Okay, whatever it is. Okay, so some people err on that side. Most of the people in our city err on this side. They take us seriously. They get to know their neighbors' names. They start to use their neighbors' names. And then they're hanging out in their driveway having a drink with their neighbor for a number of years, and we check in with them, and we go, hey, like, when's the last time that you had, like, a conversation having to do anything to do with spirituality with one of your neighbors? And they go, oh, no, I haven't done that. You've been hanging out with them for years, and you haven't had a conversation about, like, what you say is the most important thing in your life? Help me get that. Okay? And so we've come to realize that most of our people are in that camp. And there's a lot of them that are actually doing it, and they're in between. That was the hardest thing for us as leaders to figure out, because we believe deeply that people share what they love, okay? If you love cars or football or golf or baking or gardening or whatever it happens to be, and I hang out with you for 2 hours, there's a good chance it's going to leak out of you, and I'm going to know it, okay? People tend to share what they love. And then we started to realize the vast majority of our people aren't having spiritual conversations, and that really started to make us question some things. Number one, because there's only two answers, okay? Either if that's true and most of our people aren't sharing about their life with God, then that just means, number one, maybe our people don't love God as much as we want to think they do, which that is true for a lot of us. For a lot of our people in our congregations, we started to think, oh, wow, this isn't like a fully integrated part of their life. And the other thought that we realized is a lot of our people are paralyzed by fear. They don't want to have this conversation because they're fearful of what's going to happen if it doesn't go well. And so they just don't have it, period. And some of our people, we always do these things around evangelism, how to tell your story in relation to God's story. And what we started to learn is what we really do is we ask people to jump off the high dive. Okay? And I'm sure you've done this too. You do the pre-Easter, you know, we're going to teach people like how to like reach out to other people things, and then you give everybody a little flyer or 10 of them, and then they're supposed to go hand them to somebody or a door, and then Easter comes, and you look around, and your place is jam-packed, and it's just because everyone showed up on the same day, and you know in your heart, very few people actually invited somebody that doesn't know God into your place, right? We've all had that like pastor hangover moment. Leadership hangover. Okay, so it's because what we're asking them to do is we're asking them to go from like the high dive and make this huge jump to have conversations with people about their spiritual lives when they don't even know how to live at depth with people in the first place. And so we started to go back and actually just do some like very strange evangelism training, which goes like this. Hey, maybe we could just teach you how to like ask a few questions that'll get you a little bit below the surface so that when you do, maybe it creates some soil to talk about God since you're not doing it right now. So what does it look like when the believers in your church start to become the kind of people who can look at their neighbor and go, hey, your kids are like all 10 years older than my kids. What do you wish you would have done differently? Like, what would you tell me right now in this moment as I'm trying to figure out how to be a parent? Okay, now, I asked one of my neighbors that question, and his response was, I don't talk like this with anybody. It was like this moment. I was like, yeah, well. And it was saying that in a good way. To look at somebody and go, hey, tell me, like, really, how'd you end up in this field? And they go, oh, I just got, no, tell me, like, take me from college. Like, what were kind of the milestones that you ended up getting here? And allowing somebody to begin to share their story like that. Okay, when we can become the kind of people who live a little bit below the surface, then we're not asking our people aren't feeling like they're jumping off of a high dive to talk about life with God. And so it's really, it's kind of a contrarian thought. Like, we're doing evangelism training, teaching people how to be, like, better at relationships in general. Just better at asking questions and listening to people. And then, of course, it always happens. People want to know your side of the story as well. But we've had to go back to being that basic because we've realized there's a gap, that something's wrong. There's some kind of cliff and chasm that people aren't jumping across. Anyway, that's a really long answer to your question. So thanks for letting me get that off my chest. Yes, right here. Yes, good question. So he's asking about different denominations. So our group, our only thing from the beginning was, if you believe in the centrality, supremacy of Jesus, then let's play ball. Okay? And we had a specific geographic area of the city, so we weren't trying to take on, you know, it would be like, if you're in Mount Pleasanton, think about Mount Pleasanton. Don't think about all of Charleston. So it was that type of thought. We tried to think very geographically and very small. So we had some, like, really evangelical Catholic leaders that were in our place. I don't know how much you know about the Catholic Church. They have just as many streams as we do. They just don't name them. They're not all branded with a different brand. But the diversity in the Catholic Church is incredible. And so we had some great friends that were part of this. We had mainline, we had evangelical, and a few Catholic leaders. So that's what it looked like for the groups that were in that room. Does that help? Is that what you want to know? Evangelical, yeah. Yes, you're asking great question. Okay, so we learned a lot here. So first of all, my suburb, the black population in my city is not very high, like 1.5% in Denver. Hispanic population is 26.5%, okay, so, and growing for us. And so for us, it was reaching out and engaging some of those communities. Now, one of the things that we realized is a lot of the Hispanic and Catholic communities had a long history of being socially engaged, where most of the evangelical churches didn't. They were just, like, creating, you know, cool laser shows. So one of the great moments for us as leaders was bringing in and being able to cede the floor and to say, hey, listen, you guys have been doing social engagement in our city and work with the poor way longer than we have. Like, can you help us, like, get smarter about what we're doing here? And that was a real turning point to be able to, it flipped that room. All of these different things normally happen in these rooms, these unspoken, you know, and to just say, we need to be learning from you because we're realizing for us, a lot of those evangelical churches in our city, we're just starting to kind of have a social conscience about how we want to engage in our city and impact, and to be able to learn from some of the leaders who don't, you know, get a ton of platform. Like, our Spanish-speaking leaders don't get a lot of platform time in our city. A lot of that's because they're bivocational. So they're, you know, we do all these meetings, and then they're working a job and not being able to show up. So that was a real turning point. We have a high refugee population in the Denver metro area. And so one of the beautiful things that we started to learn was how to teach our people to engage people from different places around the world. And food's the answer. Like, I mean, food gets you across the language barrier, gets you across everything. I'm just saying, like, you know, my immediate neighbors are from Laos. And just to look at them and go, okay, I want my kids to experience, you know, your food. Would you be willing to do that? And that was like the icebreaker of all icebreakers, was just to be able to go into their home and to be able to eat and to be, you know, taught. And it was amazing. And I will tell you this, I thought my neighbors from Laos, I thought for the longest time, I thought, because everyone that hung out at their house looked like them. They would have parties all the time, groups of people over all the time. and it was all people that looked like them. And in my mind, before all this stuff happened around the neighborhood, I just kind of thought, I don't know, they probably just don't even hang out with us. I don't know why I thought that, but that's what I thought. Now, we've become friends over the last 5 years, and what I know now is he was thinking the same way about me. He was thinking, there's no way that this little white suburban family wants to hang out with us. And so we had both made this little, we both created this little comfort zone, this little dance where we really didn't engage with each other much at all. And the food thing is what broke that down for us. So poor neighborhoods, this is, neighboring looks different in multi-unit housing, okay, apartments and condos. So I'll talk about poor neighborhoods in a second, but apartments and condos, you're closer together. You would think, oh, we're going to see each other more, we'll interact. No, you're closer together. You just want to go into your cave and, like, get away from everyone, right? And then you've got sound issues, so there's a lot of noise conflict that goes on. The best thing that you have if you live in an apartment or a condo is you have common space. Figure out what you're going to do with that common space. Maybe it's a Friday happy hour, okay? Maybe a wine and cheese event or whatever it is, or maybe it's just a card thing. What are you already interested in that you could do in that common space that would begin to help you build some connections with the people that live around you? You don't have to make up something. Just what are you already interested in? Poorer neighborhoods, there's a trust barrier that you have to cross here that's a little bit tougher, okay? What we've found in more underserved neighborhoods is that we go in with this real Pollyannish, like, yeah, just learn your neighbor's name and then, like, get to know, and they're sitting there going, hey, my neighbor is going to steal something from me. Okay, I'm just telling you, this is what we've experienced. This isn't a race deal. Okay, this is white neighborhood, poorer neighborhoods in the Denver metro area. There's been more of a reluctance to engage, but when they do, it becomes like family. If you can get through that awkward, that barrier, it does become like family. So, I wish I could speak to the black and white thing better. But my context doesn't allow. Now, when we're with the state level, so I'm just talking about my environment in Arvada. When we're thinking Denver Metro, it's different. We're a little bit more diverse. But where I am, it's not. Yes, so Pete. Yes. Yeah, Denver's the poster child for gentrification. Back in the early 90s, we had a ballpark that was built in our city. Our inner city life was, we had neighbors that had lived there for a long time and that loved the places where they lived, but socioeconomic-wise, it was not thriving. So when they built Coors Field for the Colorado Rockies in there, it flipped our whole city around. And the change was drastic, and it was fast, and it had a lot of unseen consequences that have still caused wounds and scars in our city. And this is going on all over the country. People are moving, especially young white people are moving back into the cities. The rent's going way up. They can afford it, and it's displacing the neighbors who have been there for years, and the people that have been there for years have a history and a heart for what's happened in those communities, and most of the people that are moving in don't. They just want to live in a cool spot by the cool restaurants. And so one of the things that we've tried to do to challenge people, Bob Lupton, who's over here in Atlanta, who's one of my heroes, he wrote a book called Toxic Charity. Bob Lupton came out with us, and I'm spending a lot of time with him. He goes, listen, I've been doing this work for 40 years. You're not going to stop gentrification. You could have, if you were smart 25 years ago and you actually started to buy up land and to do gentrification with justice, but you didn't, so now you're not going to stop it. That was a sobering moment from Bob. But what he did say is this, is you can help the gentrifiers actually begin to have a conscience. You can help them understand and learn the history of the neighborhoods that they're moving into, and you can help them to understand that they're coming in with a lot of baggage. And I think that was a really, really good thought from Bob, was to say, why don't you start to bring some awareness to the dynamic that's going on, and why don't you start to, if these people like are going to move into a neighborhood, help them love the neighborhood and help them be advocates for the people that have been neighbors there, their new neighbors who have been there for a long time. And so that's a really simple thought, but it's the best thing that I've heard so far around the gentrification stuff. So, yes. Mm-hmm. Great question. Yes. How far is your closest neighbor? Okay. Right, but there could be miles in between, right? Or half a mile? Okay. So this is a great question. Here's the great thing about doing this. Okay, so you can talk about this to every single person in every single room because everyone has neighbors. Period. Okay? So, but it does look a lot different in rural areas. Okay? So in rural areas, some people move to rural areas so they don't have to be around neighbors. That's like their whole entire goal. Okay? So some people who are wealthy buy big old plots of land because they don't want to have to be around people. So that's a different thing. But in rural areas, a lot of the community, you have to really be intentional. You have to be intentional. You're not just walking outside your front door and seeing different people. So you have to be thinking about, like, I'm actually going to go all the way over there and invite and say, listen, we've never had a meal together. That seems crazy. We've been saying we're going to have a meal for 2 years. Let's just have a meal together. Okay? A lot of times it's around fences and boundaries around where the neighborhood relationship or the neighboring relationships go good or bad when you're talking to people in rural environments. But I would be lying if I didn't say in rural areas, you just have to work at it more. You have to actually be more intentional. But the great news is that it can be done. It can be done. So it is harder. I do want to say that. It is harder just because you're not as visible to one another. Visibility is a really big deal. And I'll talk about this a little bit tonight at the chapel service tonight. But like if you want to be a good neighbor, you actually have to be in your neighborhood. And you actually have to live at a pace in which you're available. That's been the biggest challenge for me and for my life is that most of my neighbors for a long time didn't get the sense that I was a very available person. And by the way, Jesus is. If you look at the life of Jesus over and over and over again, you just can't get away from it. He lives in a way in which he's available. So I'll talk about that some more tonight. Yes? Okay. Oh, especially if you're wearing a collar.
But I would say that, you know, just from my understanding of the Denver area, you probably don't have the same issue that we would have here in the South where there is a sort of a residue of the time that everybody, quote unquote, went to church.
Yeah.
A lot of people who, while they don't go to church, nevertheless still have that background. And to me, that seems to be a much tougher nut to crack.
I agree. Sure. Yeah. The person who just says, yeah, I'm not interested in the church kind of stuff. I mean, you can get into all kinds of interesting conversations really quickly with that person. And it's more refreshing. I mean, to be honest with you, I'd rather hang out with people like that than people who are like, no, I do. I'm a Christian. And then, like, they really just, for them, they're a cultural Christian. In their mind, they're a follower. So, I mean, first, because what's harder is you have to, like, help people like that, or they have to come to a moment in their own life where they actually realize, oh, this thing that they're talking about is totally different than this thing that I'm talking about, which some people never get there. Or maybe they know it in their gut. So I like to ask people, like, tell me about your faith life growing up. Who's the host of the podcast On Being? Krista Tippett, is that who it is? She starts off every single interview asking them, say, tell me about your faith life in your upbringing. And people go, oh, I'm Presbyterian. I go, no, so what did that look like? Did you guys just kind of go to church every once in a while? Like, was it something that was, like, ingrained into the life and the fabric of your family? I think that's one of the best, like, to just try not to let people off the hook by just, like, whitewashing their answer of, like, yeah, you know, I'm Anglican or whatever, you know, whatever it happens to be. And so actually just go, no, you know, so tell me, like, do you remember that? And do you want your kids? A lot of times I'm asking them, hey, do you want your kids to experience that like you did? Or do you hope for something else with them? You know, if they have kids in that age when they're thinking about that. So that's a good question because I'm not in that context. Like in the South sometimes, I'm not saying this is the case for South Carolina, but some of the pockets I've been in the South, you're weird if you don't go to church. Okay, in Denver, you're weird if you do go to church. And so it's like that you're the anomaly on the outside. So I haven't put as much thought about that into that as I could. So, all right, I'm going to do like two more. This is good. We're getting to all the stuff that I really wanted to say anyway. So I'm going to do a couple more questions before we wrap up. Yes, back there in the white shirt. Yes, in the scarf, white scarf I meant. That's a great question. So what happens if your neighbors are undesirable people and you don't really want to know them? Well, clearly, Jesus wasn't talking about them. I mean, the gospel, as far as I can read it, it's about being really comfortable. This is why this is magic. This is why this works. When you start to build relationships on proximity, you're going to be hanging out with people who you wouldn't choose to hang out with. I mean, some of my neighbors, the language they use around their kids and around my kids, it makes me, I just go, oh, you know, some of the jokes that they tell around their kids and sometimes around my kids, the values that they have, like, it's so different. And my wife and I used to kind of like just go, oh, what are we doing? And now we just kind of realize, I'm like, I wish my kid didn't learn that for like 3 more years, okay? Now we've kind of realized there is a gift here. We're in the game with it. We were there when we get to process. It didn't happen on some playground, some far away. We get to process it with them. And sometimes it's hard. Some of my neighbors, they don't like have a glass of wine at their parties, okay? They have like 9 glasses of wine. And then they start to say things, and my wife and I sometimes look at each other and go, yeah, it might, you know, hey, 3 hours has been good. It might be time to go. I am haunted by this thought, though, that Jesus is always, he's not always. There oftentimes in the scriptures, Jesus is making the religious people nervous because of who he's hanging out with. There's a spiritual discipline that doesn't make the list very often. Of the spiritual disciplines list. Now, you want to be careful with this. You don't want to tell your people to go and throw themselves into places where, you know, they might have an addiction or having stumbling blocks or something like that. But I just think so often this idea of proximity-based relationships has pushed me into all kinds of places that I never thought I would be. And so often, I just think I took some little version of like the high school thought of like, show me your friends and I'll show you your future, and you don't want to throw, you know, pearls before swine. I took these like little tidbit thoughts and I kind of created a system where I wasn't really engaged with people who were very, very different than me and who made decisions that like I didn't think were great. And that's not what Jesus models for us. And like that puts you in tension. My wife and I are like, you know, if you're not experiencing tension in how you're engaging with people who don't know God, then you're doing it wrong. If you're experiencing tension and you're wrestling through some of these things, good, you're doing something right. And so that's just what I've learned over and over and over again. And we have neighbor. Now, I think if you have neighbor that's unsafe, you know, if you're living next to a place, like, that's a different story. You need to have some boundaries and make some wise decisions about your kids, about your own life. And there are times where something really sketchy is going, like, you might actually have to make a phone call and get somebody else involved and be the bad person. They might be looking at you saying, you call yourself a Christian and you do this. I mean, those scenarios can happen, but oftentimes it's not that. Oftentimes it's just like, those guys just party too much. What do you think Jesus would be up to in those moments? My wife and I didn't have to start our own block parties when we started like really getting engaged in our neighborhoods. We just had to start showing up to the block parties that were already happening. And that has been, it's been beautiful and great, and they've welcomed us in. And there's times where I look at my neighbors, I go, hey, we actually don't like use that word in front of our kids. So could you not use that word? And that's mildly awkward. But my neighbors end up respecting it. Or they still do it, and then they apologize. They're like, oh, sorry, man. or whatever. But at least they're saying sorry. You know, it's great. And so that has been, and I'll talk about that a little bit more in the workshop. That has been one of those places where we've been stretched the most, has been hurling ourselves into some of those types of relationships. So thanks. Let's do zero more questions. And I want to do this because there's this little thing that we started to do a few years ago with our people that that really helps. Every time we talk about this, we just took a moment to take a deep breath and to get really quiet before God. And there's this really simple prayer. And it's the prayer I mentioned with small groups. And I want to just ask you to do this. And maybe God will just give you a nudge or give you a thought that is really clear and that you can put into practice in your own life. So the prayer is this. We just pray, God, what's the next small step that you want me to take with one of my neighbors? And so if you would, just bow your head and we'll just try to create a little bit of space for God to share with each of us. So Father, we just come before you right now. And my prayer is this, God, what's the next small step that you want me to take with one of my neighbors? Amen. Here's me, my hope. If God put, I'm sure somebody probably came into your mind. Well, we're at lunch. Would you just like share about that? Just say, hey, here's the person that I thought of. You know, here's the person that I thought of. For me, my neighbor Mike is like straight across the street. They moved in a year ago, and our kids are playing together all the time. And I just had that sense. You know, he just kind of leans in. He lingers a little bit with me. Like, and I just haven't really been present with him in a way that I think I should. That's what God just put on my heart. And I pray this prayer all the time, and it's amazing how often somebody very specific comes to my mind. And so for me, the next small step is to be present with Mike and to like try to have a one-on-one conversation with him that's longer than 5 minutes. And I don't know what it is for you, but I'm betting somebody, you know, some of you are writing something down. I hope that you're writing down, yeah, here's what it was. God, I heard you give me a nudge about this person. But at some point today, as we're hanging out here for lunch, it'd be great to have you be able to share that with some others. So Greg's going to come up and wrap us up and give us some directions about lunch. So
yeah, go eat.